As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Coming up on the show this week, thrown to the wolves, Newcastle leave Molineux with no points and no positives. Arbitrary nonsense, the latest episode of Netflix's least engaging legal drama. And when one tribe goes to war, why we need to rid ourselves of the enemy within. Hello, I'm Taylor Payne, and this is Pod on the Tyne, and joining me, as always, are The Athletic's Newcastle United correspondent, Chris Woff, and our senior writer, George Colkin. Chris, I heard you've been suffering after a bit of a cheap curry at the weekend, is that right?
Yes, it was my brother's stag do on Saturday, so we went to York, but because I was married during the pandemic and I didn't get to have a proper stag do, when I turned up at the station, I also found out that I had to dress up for the occasion as well, and so my brother was put into a full Sunderland strip with the guards for his chins on the outside of his socks, and there was an in joke in terms of on the back of his top. But then I had to wear a referee's outfit for the full day, full like referee's kit, and I had the red and yellow cards in the booklet, and I had to go around, and I was given the kitty, so basically it meant that I had to walk around York with the kitty, and every time I had to go and order everyone's drinks. So, but yes, then when we got back to Newcastle, I had a very cheap curry, and so I've been suffering ever since.
Oh, dear me, Chris.
Wearing a referee's outfit all day, thereby in no way confirming your image as a social deviant.
I always imagine, Chris, when you were a kid and people used to say, oh, you know, do you want to be a footballer when you grow up? And you would just go, no, I want to be a ref.
I would be a bloody good referee.
You would be an excellent ref, yeah.
Who wants to be a ref? I mean, I know this isn't a subject at all. It's like all this thing about respect to referees. I wasn't brought up to give respect to referees. No. I was brought up to think of referees as absolute weirdos. I mean, who wants to be a referee?
Weirdos, absolutely, George.
I don't have respect for that. And now I don't have respect for Chris.
Did you have that anyway? No. George, you had to try and stomach Wolves versus Newcastle, didn't you? How have you been? Have you been okay this weekend?
We'll come on and talk to that. Yeah, I'm okay. How are you, Taylor?
Well, I've been a little bit under the weather this week. I came down with a bout of tonsillitis during the week.
Oh, no.
And I've been feeling a little hoarse, which has led to me being subsequently banned from Northumberland Shetland Pony Museum. But that's that's another thing altogether. But yeah, so I'm
stick
all right
with
now,
us, man. Folks. It won't always be this bad, I promise.
I don't know if we can get away with that joke, but we'll try. But yeah, you can probably tell I'm a little bit raspy. I'm channeling my inner Barry White today. Anyway, Just so you know, The Athletic are still offering 33% off new subscriptions to podcast listeners. So get yourself to theathletic.com/NewcastlePod and take advantage of that wonderful, wonderful offer.
Come on, you Maggies.
Right then, chaps. Let's start with that defeat to Wolves, 2-1 down at Molineux. Another vintage encounter and another premium fixture discarded by Chris Woff. George, you had to suffer the ignominy of a trip to the Black Country in the pissing rain, and to add insult to injury, you had to report on yet another defeat.
I did, yes, I did. I can't say I enjoyed that. I would say at this point that I was paid to be there, unlike the Newcastle fans who filled out the away end. And so I do, before we get on and talk about the match, I do want to sort of give a shout out to them. It was a sold out away end. I knew quite a lot of people. I had a lot of friends in the away end this weekend. And to a man and woman, they've all said that the atmosphere was really flat. And that just makes me feel very sad. The nature of the away end is that it was very long and thin and stretched along the bottom of one of the main stands. So it wasn't that kind of area where you're all bunched together on top of each other. And perhaps that had something to do with it. But they've just all said how flat it was. And I do think that kind of sums up the state of the club at the minute, where people sort of know that their anger won't really lead anywhere. And it was a miserable afternoon by the end of it.
It absolutely was. I mean, Chris, the main thing we have to touch upon first really is Steve Bruce's future, isn't it? And obviously Watford have dispatched their manager this week. And what's the kind of the current take on Steve Bruce? I mean, it pretty much looks like he's not going anywhere, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, Newcastle and Watford are basically polar opposites in terms of the way that they approach things like this, and certainly it's been Newcastle in general, to be fair, for most of Mike Ashley's tenure, but certainly since the ongoing takeover saga and trying to sell the club, that Newcastle will not be proactive about this, whereas Watford are the other extreme and will sack managers at the first opportunity and do it far too regularly. I think they're looking for their 13th permanent manager in 9 seasons or something like that. And their statement was interesting, and that it talked about the sort of build-up of negative momentum and that things started to go away from them. For Newcastle, that isn't how the current board view it. And as far as we understand it at the moment, it doesn't look like there's going to be any change over the course of this international break. Newcastle are 7 games in. They've only won 7 of the last 37 in all competitions. I think it's 37 points in the last 38 Premier League games. They conceded the joint highest number of goals in the Premier League so far this season. They've got the worst expected goals against. But Steve Bruce is still there, and despite fans chanting for him in the last 4 games, despite Newcastle having been booed off in just about every single game so far this season, the hierarchy don't look at things in the same way as supporters, and so supporter opinion is not what they're taking aboard here. Steve Bruce obviously has a significant compensation that you would be due if he was to be dismissed, and so for now, Newcastle are going to stick with Steve Bruce, and they believe that performances have been better than results. They also point to the fact that Callum Wilson should be back soon, Jonjo Shelvey, Martin Dubravka, and they think they will make a significant difference to the team, which they may in many ways, but equally, the squad that Steve Bruce has and the resources he has, this team should be doing far better, in my opinion.
Bruce has said, George, hasn't he, that he's trying to change the way that we play and trying to find balance. He rolled out this quote again, but he's said the same thing for over a year, hasn't he?
Yes. Here we go. Here's a quote. "We are trying to find a balance to the team, and we are trying to change the way we play." And he said those words 12 months ago after a draw at Wolves. And here we are now with Bruce attempting to change the way the team played. They are playing in a different way. You know, they're playing more expansively. They're taking more shots and so on and so forth. And he's still talking about balance. He talked about balance again after Saturday. How long does it take to find balance? And how long does it take to change the way a team play? You know, if we remember when Steve Bruce arrived, he talked about wanting to change the way they played, but the players were more comfortable playing in a certain system, which was more defensive. Newcastle now have the joint worst defence in the Premier League. So they've gone the other way. And it's just part of this sense of nothing ever changing, nothing ever happening, nothing getting better, and still being in this sense of sort of limbo. And, you know, you look at I've sort of said this a few times on Twitter over the past couple of days. You look at every other club in the Premier League, more or less, and you can say that you know, you either know what their plan is, or you know the way they're going to play, and or you know what their identity is. It doesn't work for some of them, but you know what it is. You don't know anything about Newcastle. There's, you know, there's no plan at Newcastle apart from ticking over or ticking along, whatever it was Bruce said a few weeks ago. And you've got the manifestation of that on the pitch. Here we are, still in this sense, not knowing what they are, not knowing what they're trying to be. And, you know, it's obvious when they play, and it's obvious in the stands as well.
It is. The performance in general, Chris, as well, it wasn't particularly inspiring, was it? And Alan Saint-Maximin is ploughing a lonely furrow up front, trying to play him as a striker, or is he? I don't know whether we're trying to play without a striker or how we're actually approaching this at the minute, but there seems to be a massive lack of focal point in the team. And when you compare that to Wolves, and Hwang, who was playing up front for them, and Jimenez, it's like chalk and cheese, isn't it, those two teams?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just caveat whatever I'm about to say with the basis that I've only seen the extended highlights of the game. I didn't see the full match, so I can't comment on the entirety of that game, but I have seen their other matches this season and over the course of the last few weeks. And Alan Saint-Maximin up front is creating problems for the opposition. He's the one who still looks like he's going to make things happen for Newcastle, but there's still that part of you that wonders, if he was playing off a proper striker, then would he be creating more opportunities for them? Would he actually be in a freer role almost? He seems burdened up in that upfront role. And you look at, we've mentioned it every week, but I'm doing a piece over the next couple of days, looking at the sort of the Dwight Gayle situation. Newcastle at the minute are playing essentially without a centre-forward or without a recognised centre-forward.
He drifts
still,
Chris, doesn't he, as well? He drifts left and right. He's very rarely central.
Yeah, and
he comes wide and comes deep to get the ball, and it just leaves a massive gap.
I mean, Man City play without a centre-forward, but Man City have players who contribute goals all over the pitch. Newcastle have only got two players who've scored more than one goal so far this season. One of them is Callum Wilson, who's missed the last four games. The other one is Alan Saint-Maximin. Almiron has barely looked like scoring this season. Joe Linton has had a few opportunities, but we know isn't a clinical finisher. The midfield isn't contributing enough. Joe Willock's stats are down significantly in terms of an attacking sense. I wrote about that on The Athletic last week. Sean Longstaff's got one, but he isn't looking like he's going to score every week. Newcastle don't have enough players to be able to play in a way where they don't have a recognised centre-forward, and that's why it remains baffling that Dwight Gayle doesn't get that much game time. He came on at the weekend, and I think Dwight Gayle's had 8 touches in 20 minutes of football so far this season. That's how little Newcastle fans have seen of him. And yet, Callum Wilson has been out for the last 4 games, and he missed the final 20 minutes of the Southampton game as well.
There was something quite interesting on Saturday, tactically, actually, which I wanted to sort of bring up, which was that Isaac Hayden started off in what I would sort of describe as an elevated midfield position. He was pressing. The plan was obviously to press Moutinho and Neves and to harass them. And he was doing it. He was blocking, he was winning the ball. And suddenly, once he'd done that, he was actually then sort of augmenting the attack. And I thought that was kind of quite interesting. You expect to see Willock or Longstaff further forward, you know, possibly carrying the ball or possibly doing something with the ball. But Isaac was getting up the pitch and sort of doing that pressing job. And I thought that was actually quite effective. Now, they then concede the goal, and the first thing they do is then go back to 5 at the back. And Isaac, bless him, having sort of been doing a completely different job, is then back to playing in the right side of centre-half. And anyway, and then, you know, by the end, it was the usual. Obviously, Willock goes off, that sort of disrupts. And by the end, it's that sort of usual sort of shapeless stuff. But I just thought that, you know, the first 5-10 minutes, I thought Newcastle actually played quite well and were causing Wolves some discomfort. But it was then sort of discarded very quickly.
We seem to struggle to react, George. This is the thing, when if something in the game goes against us, we tend to find it difficult to react and how to change and what we're going to do. I mean, the standard response seems to be shuffle it to a back five and hope for the best.
Or pile players on if you're chasing a game. But I agree. I don't think that's Steve Bruce's strong point. I think there is that, you know, sort of making tactical changes within the game. I don't think Newcastle are very are very effective at that. But the thing is, they're not effective at anything at the moment. That's the point. And even though they're taking a lot more shots, for example, than they did last year, shots and shots on target, I think they're in the top, they're certainly in the top half in the Premier League with those. They're scoring less goals. So they're being way less effective at the back. I mean, they're not being effective at all at the back. They're all over the place.
Even with two Javier Manquillos on the pitch, they're still all over the place.
Yeah, well, and that's something else. I mean, I did notice that in the second half, and and then a few people on Twitter sort of noticing it. I didn't know what was happening. So just to explain, Javier Manquillo, who is Newcastle's number 19, was wearing the number 19 Manquillo shirt, but it then soon became obvious that Federico Fernandez was also wearing a number 19 Manquillo shirt for no obvious reason. I have made inquiries. It's not like an official inquiry, but I've asked somebody who was in the dressing room on Saturday, and they weren't aware of it at the time. And so, in other words, there wasn't some sort of big thing about Manquillo breaking his nose and blood being everywhere.
Yeah, it tends to be if there's blood on the shirt or something like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, but he would also tend to have a replacement. They would also then tend to have replacement shirts. This person said that they sit next to each other, and so players often change shirts at half time. And the theory was that he's picked the wrong shirt up. So, amazing. But it's another one of those things that doesn't look particularly great. The optics of that is the modern phrase, isn't it? The optics of that.
The optics, wonderful. Yeah. It doesn't look great, does it? Wolves came at us with some, with some force, and that front two that they had, the two goals were almost identical, weren't they, Chris? The ball through by Jimenez for Huang on both of the goals was like a mirror image of each other.
It was, and the thing that Tim Spears, our colleague who covers Wolves, wrote about in The Athletic was exactly how Wolves had worked on this all week, and they'd identified these weaknesses in the Newcastle side, had worked out how they were going to score those goals, and the gap. I mean, the actually more concerning for me than the two goals they conceded were, and this was Kev Lawson on social media, actually, I think, who did this. He does YI Scout, which you might have seen, a lot of analysis that he does on social media, and he showed that the chance that when Jimenez hit the bar, and bizarrely that Kieran Clarke has the ball about halfway, two thirds inside the Wolves half, he's dribbling with the ball, and there's six Newcastle players ahead of him. And Wolves break, and suddenly there's just so much space. It just shows the sort of there is this. It feels disjointed the way Newcastle play them. They are piling more bodies forward. They are creating more opportunities in one sense, but it also just feels a little bit forced. It doesn't feel like that they've yet found the way exactly how they're trying to play and what the way forward is. And then so other opposition teams, when they are doing their analysis, when they're looking ahead to matches and they're thinking, how can we pick Newcastle off here? How can we overcome them? And obviously Wolves identified this way of going direct in one sense, but then playing off Jimenez and then sending other people through. And they, as you say, they score almost exactly the same goal twice, and the fact that Newcastle didn't learn within the game itself is also worrying.
Well, that's the thing, Chris. It's to go back to the first game of the season when Newcastle lost 4-2 to West Ham. Bruce said we have to tighten up. Well, where is the tightening up? What have they been doing? Because they're not tightening up. They haven't tightened up. It's exactly the same. I mean, to concede the same goal twice effectively. I mean, Jimenez, it was brilliant the way he turned and brilliant the way he found space, and it's let's acknowledge how good it is and heartening it is to see him back and playing well again. I mean, I wish he hadn't against Newcastle, but really just quality on the ball. But and again, Steve Bruce says, I don't remember my keeper having a save to make. Well, maybe he could have tried a bit harder with those two goals. I mean, that might be one thing. I mean, I know that's a bit cruel on Carl Darlow, but it didn't strike me that he was at his sharpest. But then again, I'm not sure any keeper could be with that in front of him. And, it's that thing. Okay, if you recognise that you need to tighten up in the first game of the season, why haven't they tightened up? Why haven't they found a formula over the space of eight games in a couple of months to address this?
Yeah, it's becoming a bit of a worrying situation, and obviously we're still without a win, and the winless five from last week became the winless four after Leeds beat Watford. It's a very real threat, though, isn't it, Chaps, relegation this year? I mean, we're deep in the shit here, let's be honest.
Yeah, well, yes, I mean, the fact that Newcastle are second bottom, they haven't won any of the opening seven games. I mean, they have this record. As of last week, they were the only team to have, I think it was six times in the Premier League era, failed to have won any of their opening six. I think they're now, I think they've done it three times without won any of the opening seven. And they survived last time. That was under Benitez's second season when they were back in the Premier League, 2018-19. So, and they aren't yet cut adrift. And the fact that there are three of their winless teams still. But it is concerning. I do think that Callum Wilson, Martin Dubravka, they can make a difference. I also think John Joe Shelvey can make a difference to the way Newcastle play, even if I'm not necessarily his biggest advocate. And I know other people out there think that the team struggles defensively in many ways, but I also think the way Newcastle have been trying to play over the course of the last few months really relies upon John Joe Shelvey being in midfield and being the person who can release the likes of Saint-Maximin. And so there are reasons to feel that Newcastle can start winning games again, but the concern is genuine, and fans, I can fully appreciate why many fans are really, really concerned, because the fact that Newcastle can't win games when, in some ways, at least in an attacking sense, they are playing better than maybe 18 months ago, 12 months ago, is worrying in itself, because we saw that under Steve McLaren, and Newcastle just couldn't win games. And eventually, if you don't win games that you either are in, and it's a sort of coin flip, or arguably deserve to win, certainly they did at Watford, if you can't win those games, then at some point it's going to catch up with you. And it's almost the opposite of sort of Steve Bruce's first season, when we always said that Newcastle were outperforming the metrics. In some games this season, it's been alternative, but equally not defensively, because Newcastle are just conceding too many chances in that sense.
The counterpoint to they can win games, as you say, Chris, is that they're not winning games. And it's not just that they're not winning games this season. They've won seven games in all competitions in 37 games. Two of those games were against Fulham and Sheffield United at the end of the season, who'd already been relegated. And then we've gone through a summer when, and I don't care that the club won't want to hear this and won't agree with this, they've demonstrated their own lack of ambition by not strengthening the squad, in fact leaving the squad weaker than it was last season. And I do think this is really important. I mean, I think this is really important for loads of reasons, but it's important internally to push players. And players, you know, players want to play. That's what they want to do more than anything else. But they all want to get better, and they all want to be pushed, and they're all confident that they can stay in the team. You know, they want new signings to come in to push them and to improve them. And so Newcastle have gone through a summer where they haven't been pushed. You know, they're not pushing and they're not improving. And then you've got the head coach saying 2 or 3 weeks ago, you know, whether it was him misspeaking again or not, I don't know. I mean, it was terrible PR, albeit it was accurate, when he says, I've got to keep us ticking along to stay where we are. Because that's not pushing either. So nobody is being pushed. And that is my concern, that at some point, all right, you know, we've gone through this, these eight fixtures, which haven't been particularly awful. You know, it's not been an awful start to the season in terms of the teams that Newcastle have played, and they've not found a win. So I think it's okay to say Wilson comes back and they get better, and they do. But, you know, at some point, they're also going to come across teams who will take more advantage of the fact that they can't defend. You know, and so that is my concern. Yes, they can win games. They have got players who can win them games, but they don't win games.
Yes, absolutely. I can see us coming up against one of the big boys and getting absolutely battered very soon. And I can imagine that would happen. Okay, let's have a little break and we'll be back after this.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
So, Newcastle set an attendance record this week. The Competition Arbitration Tribunal hearing between... What's that?
No,
what's
funny.
Matter, George?
It was
it's funny.
A good line. I apologise.
I'll it's do it again. I thought I'd fucked up or something. Sorry. No. Okay, try again. So, Newcastle set an attendance record this week. The Competition Arbitration Tribunal hearing between...
The Competition Appeal Tribunal.
Well, I'm reading what's on the thing, Chris.
I know. I'm just correcting you. I apologise.
Honestly, appalling.
So Newcastle set an attendance record this week. The Competition Appeal Tribunal hearing between the Football Association Premier League Limited and St James's Holden Limited saw 33,000 Geordies tune in to the Honourable Mr Justice Miles and Co. Which means Newcastle now has 33,000 new legal experts.
What a fixture! What a fixture! That
oh was. God! Hairs on the arms, George. Hairs on the arms. We didn't learn an awful lot, although there were some tantalising cryptic remarks from both QCs, but there was one fairly concrete takeaway, wasn't there, Chris?
Yes, so this... we're going to have to presume some knowledge from people who are out there who are Newcastle United fans, and if you're listening and you're not a Newcastle United fan, as George asked last week, why on earth? But if you are a Newcastle
fan... Why would you do
this to yourself?
Spare yourself.
Yeah. Think of the
put
children.
Put yourself through this.
Then this saga obviously has been going on since... sort of March 2020 or certainly that summer to now, and so there are two
BC,
legal
2020 BC, Chris.
So there are two legal cases ongoing though, but this one is Mike Ashley's own personal case against the Premier League, and it's basically an anti-competition case that he's bringing. So what we heard on Wednesday was a jurisdiction hearing with the Premier League essentially are trying to get this case thrown out before it even begins, because they argue that arbitration, which is to do with the Premier League's owners and directors test and will determine whether or not members of the Saudi Arabian government need to be submitted to the owners and directors test, which is the reason why the test never progressed in the summer of 2020 anyway. Basically, they are arguing that these cases are both too similar. This one from Mike Ashley doesn't need to be heard. And so this really primarily is more about Mike Ashley. Equally, though, there were some interesting revelations about arbitration. So before now, after arbitration was delayed in July, all we knew is that it was quote-unquote early 2020 that will take place. Well, now we've learned, I think it was 8 minutes into the proceedings, that the Premier League's QC revealed that arbitration is due to start on or around January the 3rd. Now, January the 3rd is supposed to be a bank holiday, so it may not actually be on that day, but he's adamant that it will start, the Premier League are adamant it will start in early January of 2022, that the case will last little more than a week. And so they're even adamant that the case could be concluded, and if it concludes positively for Newcastle United, they have argued, the Premier League are arguing, that then if the Saudis do not have to be submitted to the owners and directors test, that the consortium would then pass the owners and directors test, and therefore the takeover would then be able to take place. And they argue that could be before the end of the January window. So on the one hand, you had the Premier League, who were very, very positive about the fact that takeover, weirdly, the Premier League, who are the ones who have stopped it from happening up to this point because of that, were very adamant that the takeover could in theory happen because they want this cat case to be thrown out. And then you had Daniel Jowell, QC, who is Mike Ashley's lawyer, coming in and arguing that, well, actually, we don't know whether the takeover parties are still there. We don't know, even if they are still there, we don't know whether the 305 million, but he didn't say the 305 million price, but he basically said we don't know if the price is still going to remain the same. So we're going from one side to the other of basically flipping the argument, and that because Mike Ashley is adamant that he wants this cat case to run alongside arbitration, he's basically downplaying the chances of a takeover, which he is still pushing behind the scenes, and which everything at St James's Park is basically on hold for, this specific takeover. So it was a very, very weird day in that sense, that those arguments were flipped in that sense.
Yeah. In arguing Mike Ashley's case, it was suggested as well that there have been other credible bids have existed. George, do we know anything about this?
We know that there have been other people circling around for a very long time. The issue is that they haven't got Saudi Arabia's money. So Mike Ashley has put everything into either resurrecting that or you know, looking for compensation or looking a way through, because you know they're the cash bidders here. So there are others. It's interesting to hear that said, but you know, this version of the takeover is the one that would give him the money that he wants. Whether others would is a very different question. But yeah, we know of Americans waiting in the wings and so on and so forth. But whether they would be a transformative takeover for Newcastle is a very different matter.
Just to contextualise that as well, the reason that we heard the other credible bids line was because part of the way Mike Ashley is trying to get the cat case to continue is that he's arguing that even if the takeover was to be passed via arbitration, he's had to wait 18 months, nearly 2 years for this takeover to happen, and that part of the reason why they kept on reiterating that they don't know if the consortium would pay the same sort of price is because of this time frame that has been extended over that period of time. And so they tried to show the difference between what they called quote-unquote current market value of the club and the difference between that and the bid that was lodged. Now, it was confidential, the information that was put forward as to exactly how much the bid is and exactly how much the difference is. But what was revealed is that a substantial loss that exceeds £10 million. And so the way they tried to calculate the current market value of the club was to say that they used other, quote-unquote, credible bids which had been put in for Newcastle. There was no context given as to when, no context as to who. So I think that it's also, again, sort of almost like trying to embellish that fact to try and prove that Mike Ashley's losing out on money between one takeover or another, because previously the words out of the club or from people close to the club have been that other bids have not been to Mike Ashley's liking. And I think that George is right there in the sense that this is all about the value he wants from this deal. He's been offered a specific price by the consortium, and that's the price that he wants.
Also, George, you pointed out to us that it's 4 years this week to the weekend since Amanda Staveley came to St James's Park for that first time and took in that Liverpool game. 4 years. It seems like yesterday, doesn't it?
No, it seems like it seems like 3 billion years ago. I mean, it's just, and yeah, I mean, so if she gets credit for anything, it's for perseverance and for hanging around. Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I interviewed her and Mirdad Gadousi, husband, I mean, briefly, when it all fell through last year, he talked about that day, and he said, that day we first walked in, it was a dark grey evening against Liverpool. You walked in up the stairs, through the director's area and out into the stadium, and you just felt this tremendous energy. It was incredible. As a Londoner, I'd go to Chelsea or Tottenham games and I'd never experienced anything like it. Amanda and I just looked at each other and said, this is it. This is the club we should be buying. And I met them wow. briefly that night. I knew they were coming and knew that there was sort of something in the air, but it's not like there was anything, you know, sort of definitive. It, you know, they both do say it was that night that sort of persuaded them to go for it. And here we are 4 years later, still in this exact same situation. I obviously have and do still regularly speak to the people that would have been kind of in charge of her football operation. And, you know, it's a very different situation now than it was back then in that spring when, to use those horrible words, you know, they were told that there were no red flags and that something could happen very, very quickly. They were kind of poised with potential deals with players. They were poised with, you know, with ideas about managers and things like that. And they haven't gone away in that sense. They're still there. People have had to kind of get on with their lives. I mean, you know, various points, you know, last year they'd been house hunting and things like that. You know, people have been house hunting. But there's nothing like that kind of happening now. But there are still conversations and there are still recruitment conversations. It's just they're very, very difficult to keep doing that because people they thought of or approached, well, 4 years ago, you know, Benitez was still manager and they wanted Benitez to
That's
stay.
It,
there've
yeah.
been various, there've been various moments over the last couple of years when they thought the stars might align and Rafa might be available again. And, you know, the same thing with players. I mean, they've had things, quote unquote, lined up. I mean, not deals definitively lined up, but ideas of who they wanted and sort of had conversation with agents and things like that. But all of those players have moved on or committed themselves to where they are now. Those sorts of conversations are still happening. But I mean, and I think, you know, there is a chance that something might happen in January. So they sort of have to be on their guard, if that's the right word. But I mean, I think they have the same sort of opinion that I would, which is that sort of have to get on with life and assume it's not going to happen, because all the evidence that we've had so far is that it's not happening and it hasn't happened. So I don't think there's any sort of sense of life-changing imminence about it, because we've all become sort of immune to that, and that the best way to proceed is to sort of, you know, is to presume that it's not happening. And if something does happen, then it's obviously a bonus.
Just to very briefly sum up how it finished as well on Wednesday, the case, which throughout the day it had been refreshing to hear throughout, that Mr. Justice Robert Miles, who was the chair of it, was very keen for it to be public as much as possible. So at a couple of points, the Premier League asked for the live feed to be turned off because there was things that were confidential and that were to do with arbitration. And he accepted one of their applications to do so. He rejected the other one. And his argument was that this is the bits about arbitration have already been made public, and we believe that this hearing should be in public, and that there is a public interest, as he kept saying in this. And that was refreshing to hear, that actually Newcastle fans, who've had so little information or so little clarity throughout this process, were actually being listened to in one sense from that. So that was refreshing. And then throughout the day, I mean, we heard various different accusations which have been levelled already by the prospective buyers, Nashi, that there were claims that both BN Sports and a quote-unquote a number of major Premier League clubs joined in the lobbying against the takeover deal. There was BN Sports, MENA, Premier League TV rights extension, which was cited. And there was also quite an explosive allegation, which was made almost in passing by Mr. Daniel Gell QC, that the Premier League made a threat to stop the club from playing in the competition. There was no context given to that, and with no relation to when it was, but it was just interesting to hear all these arguments.
Ages ago.
If the further
we did that ages ago, Chris. Come on, we haven't played in the Premier League. I know you're doggedly trying to carry on with your very serious point, which is to your credit. But I want to keep saying this until you acknowledge it. We stopped doing that a long time ago, Chris.
So further context was not provided this time. to when the warners were, so we got all these arguments, which were basically a preview of what would happen if the CAT case was allowed to go ahead. But as positive as it was that there was all of this information, well, more information we had previously in the acknowledgement of public interest, it sort of ended in a little bit unsatisfactorily, where just at the end it was sort of, all right, that's the end of this hearing. We're not going to make a decision today, but you'll find out sort of in due course. And so we don't yet know when exactly we're going to hear.
No spoilers,
whether this
please.
CAT case can happen. I mean, by the time this podcast is out, in theory, I suppose that CAT could have. I'm just refreshing the CAT website just to check. No, there is still no judgment.
So the CAT is still not out of the bag, is it?
We stopped competing in the Premier League ages ago, didn't we, Chris?
Yes, we did, Chris.
Acknowledge me, Chris. Refusal. Annoying. Referee. Typical referee.
Just ignoring everybody. Right, that's enough of that nonsense. I'm starting to get thoroughly bored with all this legal stuff. I'll be perfectly honest with you. If somebody could wake me up when it's all done, that would be great.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Right then, George. You've been writing about a very interesting thing this week, and that was tribalism in football. There's lots of interesting stuff in there about enmity and the ugliness that often accompanies it, which we don't want to talk about today, but I must strongly suggest to those listeners who haven't read the article that you get yourselves on the Athletic website or the app and do so. George, you quoted author Andrew Lawn in that article saying tribalism brings a sense of belonging, a sense of being part of something bigger than you, and that your role in it matters, which in turn gets us thinking about what's really missing for Newcastle United at the moment, doesn't it?
Absolutely does, yeah. The context for that piece was actually sort of the Liverpool-Man City game and a piece that one of our Man City writers had written, which in the comment section degenerated into this back and forth, basically, between Man City and Liverpool fans about attendances and things like that. And, you know, we know Guardiola talking. And there was this despairing voice from an American subscriber who basically said, I don't understand this. It's like... He described it as a dick measuring contest. It's like you're more interested in size of attendances than you are in the football. And it's like, what's going on? You know, it's like you're the global game and yet you're tiny. And it's like, yeah, mate, that's what we're all about. I mean, that's what football is. And it is about dick measuring. I was tickled by that kind of comment, and so that was the sort of idea behind the piece leading up to sort of Liverpool Man City. But yeah, Andy Lorne is an author. He's written about sort of football chanting, but he's also a Norwich fan and is part of a Norwich podcast, Along Come Norwich. But they're also like an atmosphere. They're also interested in sort of atmosphere generation and how to make an atmosphere in a stadium hostile, but at the same time staying on the right side of the law and staying on the right side of decency and taste. And it's quite a difficult thing. I mean, but, you know, the point is that for us to be us, we also need a them. You know, for you to stand for something, you've got to stand up against somebody else. And I think the sort of beauty of football, when it's expressed right, is just that tiny little... petty, pathetic, point scoring. I mean, like at Wolves on Saturday, and this is, you know, this is very, very trivial, but Wolves fans sang "There's Only One Mike Ashley," and there's only one reason to do that, and it's just to fuck off Newcastle fans in a tiny little way, and it's sort of, you know, and it's like it doesn't mean anything apart from that, and it's those sort of little things that actually are one of the kind of best things about football when it's done. You know, when it's done right, we get this huge enjoyment out of just ripping the piss out of other people, don't we? There was a quote I quoted Jose Mourinho in that piece, and when he was Chelsea manager, they played at Sheffield United, and he said something like, "Places like this are the soul of English football. The crowd were magnificent, singing fuck off Mourinho." And it's like you either get it. Or you don't get it. And I think that is... magnificent. And I think we have lost that a bit as Newcastle fans. Because the sad truth, and we've seen this a lot in the last few days, certainly on Twitter, that we're far too busy sniping at each other than we are in sniping at other clubs in a petty and pedantic manner, which can be very funny. I mean, you know... so anyway, I don't know whether you guys have any thoughts on that, but yeah, no, I enjoyed writing that piece.
Absolutely, and it was great to read as well. Chris, this is the thing with Newcastle, isn't it? We don't really have a Premier League rival, and our local rivalries with Middlesbrough and Sunderland, etc., they lie in dormant. And I honestly can't remember the last time we actively took the piss out of opposition fans. It's a shame, isn't it? Because I miss that a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of the occasion, as George is saying, it's sort of the occasion, sort of what we've grown up with. It's that us and them, but in a sort of, I mean, a large of it, that obviously it sometimes does go, crosses a line, but that large parts of it can just be, it's jovial, it's fun, it sort of just adds to the atmosphere. It's part of the experience for so many people. And yeah, Newcastle fans haven't had that. I mean, you still hear them singing about Sunderland quite a lot. Although Sunderland, I was going to say Sunderland haven't been getting battered as much, but I suppose they did lose 4-0 the weekend. But in general, they haven't been getting battered that much, so they haven't been able to sing those. But equally, I think we saw that, how much people missed that. But when Newcastle played Sunderland, Newcastle under-23s played Sunderland in the whatever the Papa John's Trophy, whatever it was called then, a couple of years ago at the Stadium of Light, that there was several thousand Newcastle fans went there and several thousand Sunderland fans turned up as well, because people long for that. You long for that sort of local one-upmanship, and that's what we all need. It for us, it adds to the experience. I suppose if you haven't grown up in it, it probably does seem petty, it probably does seem strange, but for people who've always grown up feeling that way, then it is part of the match day experience, really.
It can sear itself into your... into your psyche as a football fan, though, can't it? The thing that comes back to me quite often is the Aston Villa game, the relegation game, the banner that a sob on the Tyne and all that, who's your next Messiah, Ant or Dec? And I've never had a problem with Aston Villa in my life, and suddenly hated every single one of their fans overnight. And it endures to this day, doesn't it? It's a strange one.
That's a classic one. And I quoted the fella who actually made those banners, and he just said it was just a piss take. He said, isn't that what football's all about? It's just a piss take. It's like there's nothing more to it than, you know, nothing more to it than that. And the more that the Geordies go on about it, the funnier it becomes.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it did at the time for Newcastle. It felt like, Christ, you know, we've gone through this season. It's the most toxic season in our history. We've got to the end of it. We're gonna go down. And it's like, you know, there's no empathy. I mean, you don't expect, you know, there's never empathy in football. But it's like there's no empathy here. There's no, like, sense of understanding. It's just, you know, it's like sticking the V's up at your loss, or, you know, grinding your hand into the ground when you're on the ground, all that kind of stuff. But it was just a piss take, and that's all it was. There was nothing more to it than that. And so in that sense, I'm pleased I used those quotes from that fella, because it put it more into kind of context. I mean, I think, again, just to go back to Newcastle now, I think the problem is that Newcastle's tribal enemies are within. And it's very difficult, you know, Newcastle fans are looking inwards. They're not looking out. They're not looking out at, okay, fine, the odds, Sunderland champ. But it's like there's no time to have fun because, you know, the owner is the enemy, but the owner is also now an ally because he's made the Premier League the enemy. And the owner is also sort of, you know, Steve Bruce is there as a human shield, and so he's the enemy.
Yeah.
And the enemies are internal. So when Newcastle are sort of doing these, you know, again at Wolves, it wasn't all the way through the game, but repeatedly through the game, the chants from Newcastle fans are, get out of our club, and we want Brucey out. And so the tribalism is within our own tribe, and that is, you know, it's really sort of disappointing because it stops, you know, it's not fun
it's
to have a go
actually.
At your, yeah, it's not fun to have a go at your own. At your own tribe. That's not what it's all about. It's about us and them. And that actually reminds me of that War Flags flag from last season. And it was Steve Bruce, not one of us, wasn't it? Or something like that. Or you'll never be one of us. So again, us. What does us mean at Newcastle? It means something very, very different. So, you know, the them at Newcastle are the people who should be us.
And also as well, George, if you have a look at the comments of that on that article at the minute, there was an American reader in there, the poor sap, bless him, and says he picked Newcastle as his team during the Euros.
Oh, no.
Why would you do it? You can literally pick any team.
So sorry for your loss. So sorry for your loss.
We're born into this nonsense. We have to have this. This is what we get. You didn't need to choose this life. This life chose us. It's such a shame. I have no idea why anybody would subject themselves to this team. Anyway,
no.
A couple of comments as well, and one that particularly stuck out in the article as well, which I found was quite entertaining. From Martin V, City Ground, Nottingham, 1996, Forest at home to Newcastle. A few days after Kevin Keegan's infamous rant, this was the peak time when nobody apart from Man United fans wanted them to win the league, and we had all adopted Newcastle as our second team. So Beardsley scores in front of the Trent end. There's a brief pause while everyone collectively decides how to react, and then in perfect harmony, the entire Trent end erupts in cheers because Newcastle are now beating us and on their way to the title.
Come on!
Come on, into the second half, Ian Warne wellies one in from miles out into the top corner, an absolutely glorious strike, and the ground erupts again, knowing we've almost certainly just deprived Newcastle of the title, and my God, it's the funniest thing I've ever seen.
You can do
that
one,
just
Martin
sums it up,
V,
doesn't it?
Do one, Martin V. Yeah, no, exactly, yeah. Yes.
Get
exactly.
out of our comments, Martin.
Get out of our comments. Well, to be fair, it wasn't just our comments, that was everybody's comments. But yeah, no, that's football. That is football. And
it certainly is.
Any excuse. Although that hurts mine. That bites, actually. That bites.
It does. There's no need for that. Kicking a man when he's down. Anyway, just before we get finished, reasons to be cheerful is something we've been trying to do over the last few weeks in an effort to live on the bright side of the street. But we're fed up of being told to take the positives. So in typically petulant Pod on the Tyne fashion, we're not going to do it this week. Is that all right, George?
Oof. That's saved. That saved it a bit. Yeah, that saved it a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's because George has broken a team. I left them in perfectly good condition. Unbeaten in two before I left them.
Shut up, Chris. That is ridiculous. That's a, what a ridiculous thing to say. You've broken the entire club. Referee.
Absolutely. Wanker. Chris, you're going to be refereeing under-11s games in the Russell Foster League this weekend, telling kids to get back another 10 yards. Just upsetting people, spoiling people's weekends.
Just book people in general, just walking down the streets. Just
that's a yellow.
No contact.
Right. That's it, chaps. We'll be back next week for another episode of Pod in the Tyne. And it's the international break as well. So we'll be on the lookout for some questions from the listeners and the readers, I'm sure. So keep your eyes peeled on Twitter and the real-time section of the Athletic app, and you can let us know what keeps you up at night, other than visiting Chris's local curry house, obviously. Thank you both to you guys, Chris and George. It's always a pleasure. Thanks a lot, even in the bleakest times. And thanks to you lot out there as well for listening. And if you're so inclined and you haven't done it already, please give us a rating and leave a glowing review with your podcast provider. Okay, that's it, chaps. Say bye-bye. Bye-bye, Chris.
Bye-bye.
That wasn't Chris.
I went early.
You've gone premature there.
Sorry.
Au revoir.
Au revoir, Chris. For now, that's it. Take care of yourselves and cheerio. Do you want me to do that last little bit again?
I just can't control
it. This is the thing. I've lost control of the dressing room.
I've lost the dressing room. It's absolute mutiny.
That's very apt.
The Athletic.